I sure hope you're hungry.
Ooh, I'm starving.
Wash those hands, pull up a chair, and secure that feed bag. Because it's time to listen to Scott Tolinsky and Wes Boss attempt to use human language to converse with and pick the brains of other developers. One's way smarter than these guys.
I thought there was going to be food.
So buckle up and grab that oh shit handle, because this ride is going to get wild. This is the Syntax Supper Club.
Welcome to the Super Syntax Supper Club. This is the first episode that we have of our new Friday episode, which is we're going to be having guests on and interview, chit-chat, shooting the shoot, whatever. We call it Supper Club because it's kind of just, I don't know, I've had many good dinners with other developers and just talk about whatever and you learn a lot. Today's episode is sponsored by two brand new sponsors. Can you believe it? Two brand new. We've got Whiskey, Web, and Whatnot. They are a lighthearted podcast that samples whiskey and talks to some developers. I've been on it myself. And Strappy. Strappy is a tool for building REST and GraphQL APIs to power your content applications. They're a CMS. It's wicked. I've used it myself. We'll talk about both of these companies partway through the episode. Today with us, we have Victor Safkin from NX Dev Tools and a few other things. I'll let him kind of introduce himself. But I don't know, a couple of weeks ago, we had a show on monorepos where Scott and I are fairly new to monorepos and we were talking about tooling and stuff like that. And pretty much everybody's like, you got to check out NX. And like we looked it over briefly in the show, but we didn't really have a good idea of like where does this fit in the whole monorepo. So with that, we'll just have him on to talk about NX, but also just like monorepos and coding in general. So let's get on into it. Victor, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me. Hi, everyone.
Hey.
Yeah, I'm always happy to talk about monorepos. Yeah, monorepos is the subject that I've been talking about for so many years. So at this point, I'm like, you know, you can wake me up in the middle of the night and I will tell you something about monorepos.
Oh, good, because I'll get your personal number. If I ever have any yeah. issues, I'll call you in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
Why don't you give us an intro, who you are, where you're from, what your background is in, and kind of what you're focusing on right now.
Okay, sounds good. Yeah, so my name is Victor, and I've been programming for a very long time, around 20 years, and I used to be at Google on the Angular core team, right? The Angular bit is relevant. What's relevant is the Google bit, because that's where I've experienced like monorepos done differently, right? So, and for the last 5 years, I've been leading a project called NX, which is basically sort of tools for like a build system built for monorepos. We will talk about what monorepos are, et cetera, right?
Yeah.
But the build system built for monorepos that partially inspired to what we saw at Google, right? With the same sort of kind of sentiment, but done in a way that is usable outside. Because there are build systems built at Google, you know, used by Google successfully, and they kind of struggle to get adoption outside because, you know, it's very hard to build something for one company and then let it be used, you know. It happens, but it's not very often, right? So we try to take some of the ideas and make them sort of palatable, you know, usable by the broader community. Right?
Interesting. Cool. Well, we've got lots of questions around monorepos and the tools and whatnot. So I didn't realize that you had worked for Google before then. I'm always curious about that type of thing. After we talked about the build systems and whatnot, we had a couple of people from Google send me DMs and whatnot. And just to talk about like what yeah. it is that they actually use internally. What was that yeah. thing built in?
Okay, so the internally, I mean, there are a lot of like a family of tools at any large tech company, right? They often build everything sort of, not from scratch, but you know, they have their own custom stack because their needs are so unique, right? And also some of those tech companies tend to be ahead of the curve, like they're ahead of the industry, right? By say 5 or 10 years, right? So they cannot use what the industry offers because the industry doesn't offer anything, right? At least that scales to the degree, right? So one of the tools that they use, which is, I think, a fantastic tool, it's called Blaze. And outside of Google, it's called Bazel. It's the same kind of idea, which is a build system that you can use to To build anything, really. And the idea that you describe your computation as like this graph of tasks, you know, and Bazel slash Blaze would figure out how to run them across many machines such that, you know, you could scale horizontally, right, run very big things in there, right, while preserving the dev ergonomics of it running locally somewhat. Not perfectly, but, you know, actually well enough. And for it to work well, it had to be accompanied by other tools around. Because obviously, if you run like 10,000 projects in your, you know, CI run, you cannot just show the logs in a text, like, you know, that's not going to work. So you have to, like, a custom stack for everything. A custom stack for reviewing PRs or change sets, right? A custom tool for just viewing the logs because there is so much, you know, so much log and stuff, right? But Bazel slash Blaze is what folks right now who do certain things. If you do, like, Android development, you, like, Android Core, I think right now you have to use Bazel to build it. So there are certain things where you can sort of see it. As a front-end person, you don't see it as much unless you are, you know, in a... like work at Uber or something, right? So like in a few companies that do use it, right? So I like it. I actually think that Bazel Blaze has a few very good ideas. It's just, anyway, we can talk about the trade-offs. I think it's a good thing. People that on the team, they're brilliant people. It's just very hard for people outside of Google to adopt unless they have an engineering team who is like, we are 100 people who are just going to make it work in this company,
yeah,
right? By
yeah.
applying all their effort, right? And if they made it work, then okay, cool. Great things come out of it, right? But not every company can do that, right? And so we in many ways are inspired by Bazel slash Blaze, right? Because it did a lot of things in a very interesting way that nothing else at that point did as well, right? But you know, we sort of basically look at trade-offs and decided to not go maybe Google scale, make a slightly smaller scale, but make it usable by like a bank or something, right?
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting that the, you know, Google, I mean, has had that reputation even before monorepos became trendy for normal people. The Google monorepo was always something
back
people
in the
talked
day.
About.
Yeah.
So it's fitting that, you know, people with a background in that kind of thing would build a tool like Next or NX.
Yeah. It's one of those things where unless you actually using it day to day, it's kind of hard to. Because if you, like one of the early ones, now it's less so because monorepos have become more of a thing. Less, you don't hear as much negativity, like direct negativity, like, oh, it's completely not working in the garbage, blah, blah, blah. You don't separate responsibilities, blah, 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 right? More folks right now are like, oh, I'm interested to see what it can offer, right, et cetera. Right? And, but early on, like when we started 5 years ago, most folks who would use the word monorepo in the JavaScript space, outside of Google, Uber, and Facebook or whatever, right, would always mean, oh, it's like Lerner slash Yarn workspaces thing, right? And it's just, there's nothing wrong with them. They're fine, right? They're absolutely fine ways of doing things. But they are so different from what, say, Google or Facebook or Uber mean by monorepos. Like, they're almost nothing in common, apart from there are more than one thing in a repo, okay?
Yeah.
So like, but by this definition, you know, okay, so many things are monorepos, right? So the Google and Facebook and others mean a much more concrete way of developing, right? Then we can talk about it today, right, which has some trade-offs, but gives you a lot in return, right? Lerner and Yarn Workspaces has a very different way of developing, and they don't offer as much, but they don't ask as much as well, right? So they like kind of they appear there, they kind of do a few useful things, very cool, right? But they don't give you as much in return. So if you use something like, you know, Lerner slash Yarn, or you know, a similar kind of approach, if you can even roll your own using Bash, whatever, right? To say, oh, I would like to have 100 packages built with this, well, you're going to be in trouble, right? That thing is not going to work as well at some point, not because necessarily it will be slow. It will be, right? But also other things, like you're like, well, now it's a mess. Like, oh, yeah. Like when Google built it, it's not like you have just one giant folder when everything can import everything else. No, that's not the case. There are rules in place to make sure that the monorepo is not complete chaos, right?
Yeah.
So like it's those type of things where you experience it firsthand. You like see what maybe is important, which... It's very hard to convey sometimes to someone who is new to it because a lot of things that are important aren't important to day one. You know, like on day one, you're like, okay, it's like if you look at TypeScript on day one, you're like, that's hustle. Like you have to type this stuff, like the compiler is in a way. I can just run this file anywhere. Like how much nicer this is. No context is required for compilation. Why would ever I use this, you know, like nuisance, right? But then once you like a year in, you're like, holy, like that is fantastic, right? So useful for large system, right? So it's one of those things where anyone who tried it, they know that certain things will be very important 3 months in, 6 months in, 2 years in. And it's kind of hard to convince people that it's the case, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it is. I mean, TypeScript is the perfect analogous for that, because I mean, it is, you're solving a problem that the user doesn't have. So then the user says, there's no problem. Why am I trying to solve this problem?
Yeah, exactly. It's a bit of a, with TypeScript, at least you can say, well, you used, you know, someone who used, let's say, Java, C Sharp, you're like, remember the tooling, the refactoring that works there? Work here as well. They're like, okay, that's cool, right? So some folks can attach, but more repos are so not used really. Like they were very new to not just front end space, even in other, like if you look at the back end space and stuff, it's usually done in a very rudimentary way, right? So it's very hard to explain. Oh, by the way, it is going to be good. They're like, I don't think it is, right? I was told, you know, for 10 years that splitting things to small units is good, right? And you're like, yeah, you are splitting things into smaller units with monorepos, into more smaller units. They're just in the same repo. And, you know, things like that where it's a lot of communication breakdown happening then.
I have a question about the repo part of it, because, like, Scott and I are fairly small fish, and we've got a couple people on our dev team, and we see the value of a monorepo, but you seem to have like experience with the total opposite side, which is these massive companies, Google and Facebook and GM and things like that. Like, what do these companies use for version control? Do they literally have every project in the same repo? Do they use Git?
Okay, that's a good question. So let me first say that there is like a range or like a sizes of projects, right? And most folks who this is not to say that folks aren't, you know, clueless, for instance, but most folks are like from like large enterprises that come in and they're like, oh, but I'm pretty sure once we do monorepo, like the whole, like nothing will work. Git will not work. Git actually scales pretty well to fairly sizable repo for most, like for like, if you look at the range, right, I would say like 99.9% of repos work just fine with Git and VS Code and everything, right? They're just in this, you know, range where, yes, you have, let's say, you know, 30 million lines of code for, like, you have large systems in there, but they can all fit and Git won't struggle at all, right? And there are ways to scale Git, right? Microsoft has GVFS, which is a Git virtual file system where you can kind of check out an uber massive repo, because Microsoft uses Git to develop its massive uber projects, right? That doesn't work well with regular Git. There is a virtual file system for, I think, Windows and Mac and stuff that you can kind of clone the repo, but not really. That kind of works, right? So, but believe me, like 99% of people who think they have massive repos, they aren't in that category of massive. They are just big in practice for most teams, which is totally fine, right? So not everyone has 20,000 developers contributing to the same, like, that's totally fine. That they are in a bracket where regular Git works, right? Companies like Microsoft, in this case, had their own custom sort of, you know, Git, I don't know, not Git backend, but, you know, whatever, present your Git frontend, while the way of manipulating files is different. Google has their own custom solution from scratch, you know, because obviously you cannot check out a repo that massive anywhere, right? So I would say that for most folks who are skeptical, okay, you can look at Google and say, oh, you know, that is not going to work ever, you know, that is scary. But really, you are not in that, you know, you're not going to be in that business, right? If you're a bank, or like if you're like a company and you have, I don't know, you have a good engineering team, right? You can have a few monorepos. A few monorepos sounds weird, but a few repos that, you know, we have multiple projects in them, and each of them will easily fit in a normal Git repo. You can easily open it in your web store or VS Code or whatever, right? So it will work. It's still a big repo, right? It's just that it's big and that it's like enormously crazy, scary big, right? It's like it's like when you move houses, you can talk about how, like, what truck to use, big truck, even bigger truck. Okay, that is, you know, that most companies are in that space. Google is the space of, like, giant container, like, you know, shipping containers, you know, like giant ships, right? So, like, it's just whatever they care about doesn't apply to pretty much anyone. And everybody, pretty much anyone. So I'm actually again saying that Google's type of tool should work for you, right? Because really, you are not Google, and you shouldn't be. If you're a bank, you just structured differently. That is totally fine. You can borrow some ideas and say, oh, let me figure out if I can use some ideas wisely at a smaller scale. Because when you go to a smaller scale, there are certain trade-offs that work differently for you. So you can actually have a much nicer dev experience for you at that smaller scale than Googlers have for their own apps at the larger scale, right?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that makes sense. Cool. What is NX? I think we'll get into the questions of like what does it do? Does it replace this thing in relation to? But like, give us your elevator pitch of what it is.
Yeah, no, it's a good question. So It's basically like an extensible build system, right? And it really does two main things, right? One, they are connected, but it can be explained in a distinct way. One, it does the monorepo bit, right? And we can talk about what it means. Essentially, when I say it does the monorepo bit, I mean is that you can put a bunch of packages, modules, right, in your repo, right? And the next would understand relationships between them, right? So basically, it would create like a graph, like a, it knows what depends on what, in what way, etc., right? And it knows it automatically because Annex analyzes your source code to figure out how relationship, like if your app imports a lib, it just knows that it imports, so it knows that there is a relationship between them, that, you know, the app requires that lib. You know, if you end-to-end test runs against the app, same kind of stuff. It automatically looks at your source code in a smart way to make it fast, etc. But anywho, so it does it. It creates this view of your workspace, right? That's one thing it can do. And the second thing, it knows what you can do to things in your workspace, right? For example, if you have an app, you can say, oh, you can build it, or you can test it, right? Or you can lint it. So but you can look at your NPM scripts, but you can also use like Annex plugins to convey more information. But anywho, so it looks at it and say, oh, you can build this app. Well, the app is going to create files in that folder, for example, it knows, right?
Yeah.
So it has these two parts. It knows basically a set of verbs, like what you can do to different parts of your workspace, right? And it knows how different parts relate to each other, right? And because it knows these two things, right? And it knows it again, automatically, whatever. It can now do interesting things with your workspace. For example, you can say, oh, if I build the same, like this app, if I build it again, if I build it already in the past, right? Don't build it. Just replay the output. Show me the terminal output as before. And it would do, I think, the best job among the tools to capture output as is, because it's very hard preserving colors and everything. So it looks as if it was printed right now by the computation and put all the files where the files belong, right? As if the computation happened right now. It can do this thing because it knows how different parts relate. If anything your app depends on changes, it would know. So it would know it and it has to recompute the app, things like that, right? The second part it can do is to say, well, because I know how different parts relate to each other, right? I can run this computation, this build. Let's say you have 20 apps and 100 libs, and they all depend on each other in crazy ways, right? Yeah. Instead of running on one machine, you can just run on 20 machines, right? And it would know that, oh, I need to build those things first. It will start building those things. Then once they're built, different agents would pick up different parts of the work. So from your point of view, you're just running one command on one machine. Your terminal output all appears on one machine. All files appears on one machine. But the computation can happen on 20 machines, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like behind the scenes, right? So you have the dev experience of a one machine execution, right? A kind of naive CI. This next CI usually looks very naive, like just a chunk of builds, tests, lints. And somehow it's just fast, regardless of the size of the repo. So that's the second part that can do monorepo-wise, right? And I think the second part, the scaling part, is what I think is hard to do. Google obviously does it, because otherwise... but that's the part where when folks reach a certain scale, they see the magic. Because distributing things actually is very hard, right? Especially when it comes to things where there are dependencies between them, right? Oh, I need to build those five libs to build that other lib that then enable me to build those apps, which then I can use to run end-to-end tests against them, right? There is like different things that depend on each other in interesting ways, which means that you cannot just say, run five things here and five things here, because agents in CI have to share files, swap files, to do all the things such that they have the right things in place before they run a particular part of this computation, right? It can do that, right? So the result, basically, you have a transparent, I put it in quotes, because, you still know distribution happens, right? But by and large, you don't have to care about distribution. You just, if you want it to be fast, you just put more agents and things get fast until a certain point, right? That's one part.
Yeah.
The second part of Annex is sort of the CLI DX part. It's saying that for any large org, if you are, a retailer, right? The big retailer, and you have 1,000 developers contributing to the same repo, if you can make it fast, let's say using Annex, but the second part you need to make workable, right, is that it's just maintainable, right? The maintenance part people often neglect, because fast we kind of have intuitive thing about, well, I know what fast is. I generate 20 projects, it should be kind of fast, right? Most people understand what fast means or scaling means.
Mm-hmm.
The maintainability is harder because we were like, well, I'm building this one app on this repo, it's maintainable. So what's the problem, right? And so in there is to say that, well, if you have this giant system, right, or multiple apps built by different teams, for it to be maintainable, you have to have some consistency, right? You need to ensure that things don't import each other in a crazy way, that, that if you're building a private lib for yourself, in the same monorepo, a Bob from over there is not going to import into it, right? And now he depends on your lip, and you know, it's no longer private, right? So things like that, for example, right, have to be put in place, right? Code generation, code augmentation, being able to migrate things, like let's say if you're using Next 11, you're going to Next 12 or something, right? With the Next, you can just say go to 12, and the Next will look at dependency that you have, you know, update your package to JSON, and update your source code to work with 12. You just look and say, what do I need to update in your repo such that it works with 12, right? Because again, if you're a big retailer, a big bank or whatever, right, it's very hard to go from version to version. If you have this massive system, you're always stuck behind. So this is not fast, right? This is something that folks don't see right away. But like a year in, you're like, okay, that actually maybe is even more important than being fast, right? Because I can kind of put together fast bit ad hoc. Most organizations are able to kind of stitch it together in some ugly way, right? And it's reasonably fast. The maintenance is where they trip over. Like a year in, it's like if you don't have good stuff in place, you're in a mess, right? And then you're saying that monorepos are a disaster because, well, yeah, you have to have something that, you know, helps you keep up to date, ensures that things are well maintained, that things are consistent, blah, 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 right? Things like that.
Okay. So what's the, how does NX help you with that? Like, let's say, there's a major version of Next.js and React have come out. Like, what does NX do, like, as a developer? Okay, all right, I need to upgrade this thing. I would have to, like, go through all of my projects that touch upon that and make sure that it's all updated. What does NX do for me there that's so helpful?
Yeah. No, it's actually a cool, like, I know it will sound kind of simple, but I'll explain it. But then I will give you an example where it actually, like how it works in practice with a real world example, right? And the way it works is that if you are moving, say, from Next, you know, A to B, and there are other things that can come along and make it a mess, right? Okay, Next by itself is not, it's actually fairly straightforward because it's, I think every single library is usually not that hard to move. The problems usually arise when you have things like, let's say, Cypress and Storybook, right? The two separate tools that can be used together. Right.
Yeah.
So when you move to latest of both, latest of they're not synchronizing with each other, right? So like you need to make sure that the combo works, and that's where the more sort of narrow cases occur, right? But the way it will work is that when you run an X migrate and you can provide the name of what you want to go to, let's say if you just say an X migrate latest, the next command is going to look at everything you use in your package to JSON. It will fetch metadata, right? About things like Next, JS, whatever you use in there, right? It'll get this metadata and be like, okay, you're going from 11 to 12 of Next. Usually, like the way it works is that we provide this like an Next plugins, which is basically a tiny wrapper around the tool to make this happen, right? So fetch this metadata and it'll say, oh, you're going from version A to B of like 11 to 12 of Next and like 4 to 5 of Cypress, and like that's what you want to do. You want to go to latest of everything, right? It would reconcile it and it would say, oh, there are two things I need to do. I need to update your package versions, your node modules, package.json, with the versions, you know, that not just the plugins, but everything that, so it's consistent, right? Say, like, Cypress will go to this, Storybook will go to that, Next will go to this, right? And then it would collect a set of recipes, and I will talk about it in just a second, and it'll just say, it will create a file called migrations, which is basically it's going to list recipes to update automatically your workspace to work against the new versions of node modules, right? So it will do that, and then it will run the npm install to install the new versions, and it would run the recipes to update your workspace, to like to update the config files, to update the source files, such that it works with the new thing, right? So let's say, I don't know, like Cypress changed something in the how they write the specs, right? It would update the version, like, oh, that's not compatible. It's going to run that thing. We'll find all the specs you have in your workspace, and would rewrite them, right, to work with the new version of Cypress, right, for you automatically, right? So the way, for this to work well, you need to be able to do large-scale file transformations, right? Like, so Next comes with a virtual file system and a set of utilities that help you write those large-scale file transformations in a composable. And I think it's relatively easy, just, you know.
Oh, is that, that's like code mods?
Yeah, it's similar in spirit, right? So you can think of it as like on steroids in that now that you have them, you can compose them in very, like in lots of interesting ways, right? And it allows you to like draw around them, for example, to say, ooh, let me see what will happen if I run this transformation. Like you're like, okay, ooh, I can see, right? It's going to change this. This is not right. So it allows you to compose side effects in an interesting way. But anywho, so it does this, right? And as a result, you are able to move your workspace in a mostly automatic way. not sometimes things occur where it's like, okay, the tools just cannot fix it everything for you because some APIs are just unfixable. Okay, so
yeah.
But if you kind of lean on what we offer on the plugins, we try to, for example, with Cypress, we shield you for some by having like an anti-corruption layer saying, well, if you use Invocus via this function, we'll make sure you'll never be broken, kind of stuff. All right. And as a result, we kind of, I don't know, 95% of the things are handled automatically. The 5% is like the manual way, like, we tried, you know, but it's just, you know, it's, like, we don't control those tools, so we cannot ensure they always work. All right. I'll give you one example. So when TSLint and the ESLint thing happened, when TSLint got deprecated, right? A lot of companies still use TSLint. You have, like, you have 10 million lines of code linked by TSLint. It's a trouble because now it's a dead project, right? So you cannot be using it, right? And so we wrote a set of migrations to map against different, like map TSLint rules to ESLint rules, basically okay. automatically, right? So in this case, you would run those. We would look at your TSLint configs and we would generate similar ESLint configs, right? In that as close as possible, such as if what you lint is actually the same, and remove TSLint. And it kind of almost works. So like there are a few corner cases where you had to be like, okay, there is a lint error now because, you know, it's a different tools, right? But even in that relatively, like, it's kind of extreme case in that the tools are different, right? They're not the same. It's not like moving from version A to B. Most folks we work with, because we also consult large companies, right? We're able to move like within days. Like on Monday, you use like TSLint for your giant workspace. On Wednesday, you see TSLint everywhere, right? So that's an example where if you didn't have it, those companies would have been forever stuck with TSLint. It just, because it's like, who is going to pay? What business is going to be like, you need to spend 3 months right now moving your lint files, right?
Yeah, right.
And then we're like, okay, you know, it's not happening. Right? Yeah. So things like that is what I think is, like, again, it's hard to explain on day one because you're like, yeah, we'll figure it out. You know, why do I care? 2 years in, you're like, oh, Webpack 4.5 is a, you know, it's a hassle, right? But it's not a hassle if you go via Next. It's just, again, like 95% automatic. But there might be some edge cases in that, right? But by and large, it kind of works, right? So it's hard to appreciate unless you are like have a giant project and you're like, okay, you know, we're always behind. The business keeps, you know, hitting us with a stick that we, you know, need to ship new features. It helps you to kind of completely get rid of this part and say, you know, how about some tool to move my stack basically, right? Forward for me, mostly automatically. And it was like a few minor manual interventions in there.
To me, that sounds really nice. As someone who has written tons of find and replaces in my life, which is like the sort of the poor man's code mod, I think it's nice because it's not just like doing a find and replace or a regex on it, but it also knows about your code base, right?
Yeah, yeah.
All right, let's talk about one of our sponsors, Whiskey Web and Whatnot. It's a podcast about web development, but also whiskey and I'm assuming Whatnot. I've been on it myself. I did a little bit more Whatnot than whiskey and web, but it's pretty interesting. So they are more than a typical dev podcast. They're better than this one. They show a lighter, more human side of developers. I literally was talking about tractors for probably 10 minutes on it. The past guests include Tom Preston Warner, Kenzie Dodds, Charlie Gerard, and of course, myself. I've been on it. I sampled some whiskey myself on it. They've discussed everything from Next.js and TypeScript to Chuck's past life as a blackjack dealer, Cincinnati chili and casseroles, and of course, whiskey. So pretty cool dev podcast. You can check it out on whatever podcast player you're using or whiskeywebandwhatnot.fm. Thank you, WWW, for sponsoring.
So, okay, so a lot of times now developers, they have their like parade of tools that we're using, right? We have, whether it's Parcel or Vite or Webpack or any of these. And so one of the big confusions I know for some people is they see NX as a build tool or a monorepo tool or something like that, where How does it fit into the puzzle of, let's say I already have services that are using Parcel or using Vite or whatever. How does it work with those tools, or does it work with those tools, and how does that puzzle fit together?
It's a good question. So I think there are two parts to NX. There is an NX core, and NX core is basically a generic task orchestrator, right? In that it can run processes across machines and cache files, but what those processes do, it cares not about, right? So
okay.
Like you can run like Java, Bash, you know, TSC, SW, whatever you want to do, right? It just doesn't matter because it's a generic task. So that part is completely technology agnostic, right? Some of the parts that we built is built in Kotlin for the backend. Obviously, the next stuff is built in TypeScript. So they're different. It works the same way. It just doesn't matter, right? So that part, you throw anything in there, it works. The second part, which is, so that part is the sort of the fast scaling part, right? Works same way, caching works, etc. The second part where it's technology specific, which is with NX, you can write what we call an NX plugin. The word plugin is scary, but it's like really what they're talking about is just an ability to write like a custom, two custom things really. A custom executor. An executor is basically like a typed NPM script. Think about executor to an NPM script as TypeScript to JavaScript, right? It's that same idea. You can run a thing, but an executor is an NPM script that can provide metadata, right? That's all your VS Code integration works, etc., right? And it allows you to express long-running processes better. It's more composable. So NPM scripts aren't composable really well because it just processes. Status code is the only thing you can compose there, right? So that's one thing. So you just say, ooh, if I write this, right? For example, if I have an executor wrapping, I don't know, TSC or SWC, right? So what will happen is that then my VS Code can give me hints about which flags I can pass, blah, 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 right? Things like that, right? And the second part you can write plugins for is a generator, which is like that. The migration thing I talked about is a virtual file system and everything is cool. It's the same stuff, yeah. Just not for migrations, but for creating new artifacts, right? You can right-click on a folder and say, I want an XJS page in here, and it will tell you, okay, customize a few things. And as you're customizing the VS Code, it will show you the preview of what would be generated if you choose to commit to it. And say, oh, it looks good, commit to it, etc. So those are the two parts, right? So let's say a new technology comes up. Let's say I build my own bundler because bundlers are hot, right? And like Victor Bundler, right? And okay, so I can use it without any plugins at all and just say, well, I can just invoke Victor Bundler in an NPM script, right? Or like it will work, right? No extra metadata, of course, right? But the caching would work. The bundler would work in the way it works with anything. It works with Learner, Yarn, TurboRepo, etc. Exact same, right? So our next core in this case would be in that kind of bracket, right? It will distribute, like process that runs the bundler can be distributed, etc. So it will do general stuff. However, if I release a new version of Victor Bundler with a break and change, it won't know about the break and change because, you know, from the point of view of NX, it's just a black box. Like you're running a process in there. It doesn't know how the process is configured, what it does, etc. All right?
Yeah.
So in this case, if you want to aid that and say, oh, I'd like to have a few generators to generate different versions of the config for Victor Bundler, right? Or have perhaps shield it a bit against blacky changes. Okay, you can write a plugin for it, but it's an optional step, right? It's something other tools just don't offer. So in this case, the NX core would be more comparable. So if you compare, say, Turbo and NX, right? You'll say NX core and Turbo are more like feature-wise similar-ish, right? Whereas plugins are just extra. You don't have to use them at all, right? They're really truly optional. NX based off the single package you can add and you get the core. The plugins, though, don't replace your stuff. It's not the right way to think about it. They kind of, if you have a plugin for Next.js, they kind of wrap Next.js to provide a few affordances, like migrations, some generators,
okay. And
a few affordances for dealing with scale, right? For example, most JavaScript tools like Next.js CLI, Next.js CLI, right? So there are some problems with putting it in the monorepo because if your Next.js app depends on, let's say, a library of shared components, which you want to build, right? Then, so how do I import it? You actually need to override the import such that you import from the place where the library is compiled to. So you don't import from the source, right? So things like that rewrite cannot happen in package.json. Most folks put it in package.json, but it sucks, okay? Because it breaks your refactoring in VS Code. So you actually, your VS Code should point to source, right? But when you build, you want to say, hey, wait a second, actually that import goes over here, right? So things like that, those plugins do to make some things that are monorepo specific, which folks at Vercel, I mean, until recently, didn't care about very much. So the experience is kind of, you know, has troubles, right? It does that, but it's truly optional. So if you really want to throw an exit at any project, you can do it. It will work with any Yarn workspaces. You know, just run a command, it just works. But you won't get magical migrations as a result because obviously magical migrations kind of require you to tell us that I'm using remix for something,
yeah.
Right? And remix,
okay.
Something like that. So it's basically optional things that most smaller teams may not care about very much. But larger teams do care because for them, the cost of those migrations and stuff, right? That's where, you know, they can save a lot of time, right?
Okay. So that makes sense to me. So it doesn't necessarily replace any of the existing tooling that you have. So like if I'm using Vite or Parcel, or like as my other question is like Babel, TSC from TypeScript, SWC with TypeScript, those things are still happening on the hood. You guys aren't building your own TypeScript compiler or something like that.
Yeah. So that's actually an important thing that I want to point out. In general, I have a suspicious when I see a full stack closed tool. Right, there are some smart people working. So I don't want to mention them, not to really, but when I see like we are going to implement the whole stack from scratch in a given language, it's like, okay, that's cool in principle. When I look at the history of the industry, those tools don't usually work out. Right, like the tools that work out, right, you know, are tools that say we're going to do some things well, and you can just put whatever you want in this plugin that we offer.
Yeah.
Right? So I think that in the long run, those tools tend to work. Kind of survive more because really the industry moves so fast, right? While you're rewriting every single one thing, that new thing can show up, right? And you're like, okay, so what do I do now, right? So we really believe that we do some things really well, which is we do this task orchestration distribution really well, right? Better than anyone else outside of Google, et cetera, right? But, you know, and we do well this, you know, providing the wrappers around existing tools, right?
Okay.
It's very easy to do. It takes like a day to write. We have, you know, custom like the guides. It's not hard to do. And then you have nice VS Code experience. Generators work beautifully. Migrations work. We are not interested in building the bundler or the compiler or anything like that. Because folks who worked on, you know, SWC or TSC, they should be doing the compilation bit.
Yeah.
They're experts in that. Good for them, right? So we just want to use it well. Such that it fits nicely with the rest of the stuff, right?
And that also probably helps your adoption because nobody wants to rip out their tools that they've
exactly.
spent a month creating or getting perfect.
It's very hard to, like, people don't realize how hard it is to get the experts. Like, for example, the TSC and SWC is a good example. TSC, like, SWC is a good, fantastic compiler. We have support. We actually have a converter from TSC to SWC. You can just write in the whole repo becomes SWC. But the type checking is actually the hardest bit, right? And the type checker is still done by TSC, built by the team at Microsoft, right? Because the type checker is very hard to write. The compiler is easy to write. The type checker is, well, like, not easy, but easier than the comparison to the type checker, which is super hard to write, right? So, like, I'm in no way, it would be my nightmare to think that I have to re-implement the type checker, right, that Microsoft team is working on. Because, A, it's so close to impossible to do, it's very hard. But B, we will always be behind, right? Because, you know, new version of TypeScript is released or whatever, you, like, need to. It's a headache. I'm not interested in, like, it's my nightmare. Yeah, no. We just want to do, what we want to do is to say, we can wrap it and we can distribute across machines. Here you go, all right?
Let's take a quick break and talk about one of our brand new sponsors, and that is Strapi. Strapi is an open source headless CMS. It's 100% JavaScript. They give you a GraphQL API. They give you a REST API if you want that. I've personally used it myself. I've built a couple little applications in it, and it is awesome. You can pretty much make it do whatever you want. It's got authentication and roles baked right in. That's some of the hardest stuff of building it. It takes all the heavy lifting out of building a backend API. So if you want to build the backend API for your, your iPhone app or for your web app or for literally anything, Strapi is going to be the CMS for you. They have a huge marketplace of plugins to extend your content workflow and integrate with the Strapi app. That's the backend that you can log into and start editing all of your content. It's pretty sweet. So check it out on your next project that you're going to be building. I want you to give it a try at Strapi, strapi.io/demo. That's going to give you a demo of it. You, at the very least, just go check out strapi.io. Their freaking website is sick. Just like the scrolling and the, I can't even explain how awesome it is. I need you to go to strapi.io and check this out. If you are missing a content workflow, you go to market.strapi.io and you can see some of the awesome plugins that they offer. SEO plugins, configuration sync, CKE editor, email designer, Gatsby preview. So if you're building a Gatsby website, you can integrate this and get that live preview. You name it. I'm just scrolling forever and the list of plugins never ends. So check it out, strapi.io. You can go to /demo and you can also go to their YouTube channel as well. They've got lots of videos in there. Thank you, Strapi, for sponsoring. I want to talk a little bit more about the caching and skipping builds of things because, like, that's a big one, is that you make a change to something, you get commit, you automatically deploy it, and sometimes you're sitting on your hands for 10 minutes before that change is deployed. So, like, what are some examples of monorepos that A, need to be, like you can speed up the deployment or the build or whatever, and B, like why would you need to split something amongst 20 computers for a build? Like what are people doing besides linting and bundling? Like, what are bigger things that people doing where you're like, oh, we're saving minutes here, you know?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. Yeah, it's let me just explain what caching means, and then I'll talk about, you know, how it fits into the rest of it, right? So the way I call it computation memoization. People are like, okay, that is, I was got a lot of negative feedback because I was like, well, because the word caching implies something, it gets something that's outdated, really, right? So you're like, get something from the cache, but you know, there is a new version, there is expiration. And here, that's not the case. What we're talking about is that if I'm building, say, my next JS app, you know, what an X, or the tool like an X does, and there are a few tools that do the same, it will basically say, okay, I know what you're trying to do. I'm going to include certain things into this as inputs into this build, right? Like relevant source files, for example, you know, relevant runtime variables, what actually you typed in, the flags, basically, right? And you can customize the next. Everything next is customizable, so you can pass different ones. But anywho, something like that, right? So now it has this, it then reduces this to a value, to a hash, and say, okay, now I have this string that uniquely identifies this computation, right? Meaning that once the computation is done, I can associate the terminal output and the files created with that string, right? Basically, and put it somewhere, either locally or in a, you know, S3 or something, like some distributed storage, right? But now I have this. So next time you're running this build, I'm going to create the same hash, right? And say, okay, have I seen this before? Right? Because okay, now we have the string. Yeah. Locally or again across machines. Usually you get something from CI, right? Say CI built something on main, you pulled main in the morning, then, well, obviously everything should be cached because CI just did it, right? In this case, what you would do is like, oh, I've seen the thing. Oh, someone else computed this before. You get the artifact, you know, from storage, you know, unpack it, put the files where they should be, like as if they were created right now, right? And then, you know, print the terminal output in exactly the same fashion, right? So, like, it looks as if you just ran it, right? Obviously, when I say it looks like, there are certain things that I would, like, timestamps would look different, you know? So it's not, like, magically we replace it. Like, there are certain things you would see that, okay, we actually tell you, like, in a small bracket that was retrieved from cache, right? We do actually better than this. So if we know that whatever you're trying to unpack or download is already in the right place in the right folders, we kind of treat different, mm-hmm. right? And say, okay, don't do anything in there, right? That matters for local development, where if you're doing like constant builds, there are tools that can watch these folders. You don't want them to be like triggered every time the folders have been, you know, removed and read, even though they are the same. It's just slow to remove and read files if you do it in a local watch mode kind of stuff. So that's caching, right? So when you push your PR to CI, for example, right? One thing that an X will do, it would first check, okay, look at your repo. It will analyze your PR and say, what part of your repo might be affected. What might is important, right? Theoretically, might be affected by this PR. Like, they say you have three apps, you have a shared lib that only affecting two. You change the shared lib. The third app, in this case, won't even be considered, right? Because there is no way that the shared lib affects the third app. Hence, you know, don't worry about this. Let's just look at the shared lib and the two apps, right? So now it's going to test, lint, and build those three things. It might happen that if you, let's say, made a change to, you know, you send a PR, one of the apps build broke or something, right? You didn't fix it. So you go and you change it. You push a second commit. In this case, the shared lib is exact same, right? Than before, than the previous rounds with CI. One of the apps is exact same. And so in this case, those will be just retrieved from cache because the same property that happened locally would apply. So in this case, you're saving computation, okay? So that's caching. A natural conclusion, like extension of caching, right? It may not seem like a natural extension, but it is that once you really believe in caching, right? You're saying, why don't I distribute? Because what distribution is essentially is saying that if I run it on one agent, I can kind of retrieve it from cache on a different agent, replay it. Even if you don't call it caching, it's de facto the same thing. We're saying I can replay the computation that happened on one machine on a different machine to enable distribution, to coordination between many, many agents, right? It's like, caching kind of enables distribution, really, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so why do you need both, right? So, like, what? The point of caching is that you don't want to compute something you don't need, just a good thing in general, you know, good for the environment, faster CI, et cetera. Just a good thing, right? And there are some use cases where it really matters, like if you have, say, a system built out of multiple buildable things, shared libs, you should never touch. The shared libs is changed only by design team or something, right? Well, like, why are you rebuilding it every time? Just get it from cache magically and, you know, and only build the apps, things like that, right? The second, the problem with caching is that it can help you reduce your average CI time, but not the worst case CI time. On average, you don't rebuild everything. You only rebuild a fraction of things. So yes, your average CI time can, if you have a big repo, can go from, I don't know, 5 hours to 1 hour or to 20 minutes, right? To 20 minutes, but the worst, like, on average, because you only rebuild a small fraction of it. Like 5 hours is a very big, let's say 3 hours, 20 minutes. So it's a bit more, you know, realistic. And, but the worst case CI time can still happen. You can change every single line in the repo. Or like reformat everything, pre-check, get updated, or something, right? Or you change some super duper util at the bottom and it just changes everything, right? The worst case CI time can happen, right? So even if the worst case CI time happens once a week, if it takes 5 hours, it's unusable. It's just not usable, right? If you're saying that now you're paranoid about changing the utils, you're like, holy, better not touch the utils because that CI is going to run till tomorrow, right? It doesn't make
sense,
right?
Can't do that because it's going to take forever. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It actually changes your habits in the worst kind of way where you're like, ooh, I don't want to touch that. It's too... Whereas if you're saying that the worst case CI time can be slower than the average one because on average, you're not building the slowest app, maybe, you know, blah, blah, blah. But it still should be reasonable, right? Let's say 20 minutes or something like that, right? Well, that the only way for you to get it, to go from 3 hours to 20 minutes, is to run it on, I don't know, 10, you know, 15 machines at the same time, right? Different parts of it, right?
Yeah.
And that's sort of, you have to, every large enough monorepo has to do distribution in some fashion because there is no other way for you to scale. Just you hit a certain point that no matter how much you optimize with caching, et cetera, you have to distribute. So the choice you only have, you're distributing sort of ad hoc by saying, I'm going to run some tests here, some tests there, some builds here. That doesn't really work for large enough repos because there are dependencies between things. Or you do this, you know, kind of transparent Google style, pretend it's one machine but runs 20 machines kind of thing, right? For most folks who like build, if you're in a bank or whatever, right, you build some giant bank app, right? That thing can build, just build as itself can run for 30 minutes. So you want to split up the builds, you know, try to run it on multiple machines. Functional tests can run for another couple of hours, right? So it's, you hit this limit at an enterprise, right, very quickly, partially because it's kind of hard to maintain that code base and keep it super fast in CI because, you know, it's just lots of developers doing lots of interesting things, right? But apart, it's kind of inevitable. A large enough system will exceed one machine, right? It's a given. So the only question at this point you're faced with is to say, well, I need to split it somehow, right? And the question is how, right? And then you decide, you know, what strategy you use, right? We try to make it as, you know, it's still, distribution is still there, so you still need to consider some things, right?
Yeah.
But by and large, right now you can pass, when you create a new workspace, you can pass CI, GitHub Actions, and we just generate a custom, like a 20-line workflow without distribution for you. Because distribution is really, caching is cool. Distribution is what really matters, really. Because really, caching is just an optimization for distribution. Like, if I had unlimited money, I could just always distribute everything. It would be still pretty damn fast, right? It's just I would run unnecessarily, you know, I would pay for much to compute for no reason, right? Really, here, we're trying to minimize your bill, right? And also, you know, it lowers the average time, average CI time for sure.
Ah, cool.
Does make sense?
I'm thinking, like, yeah, absolutely. Like, it's kind of interesting. You think like, oh yeah, obviously the big one is like linting and building, and then there's tests that can take forever, and you can distribute those out. And like, do people use it for like image assets and video and stuff like that as well, where like you need to compress or something like that?
So I actually don't know if folks do it for image assets. You know, you could probably do it, right? I will give you like a realistic example. So think about it. If you have a shell app built out of 10 modules using module federation, like sort of micro front-end-ish things, right? And then they depend on, like, say, 5 shared libraries, right? So you need to build the libraries, ideally in a distributed fashion, so as fast as you can, build those 10 things, whatever you can retrieve from cache, and then the shell. Everything has to be retrieved from cache or built, because for the shell to appear, always has to come together, right? And then you have end-to-end test, let's say written in Cypress, running against it, right? So you basically say, I would like to end-to-end test my app. That is like, ooh, for you to do it, we need to build the shell. Oh, for that to happen, those 10 things have to be built. Ooh, for that to happen, those 5 things have to be built, right? And that combo by itself, that's, you know, that could be a long time, like hours if you just run it on one machine. But if you distribute, you can, you basically look at the slowest path to the root, right? And you're saying, well, the slowest path would be, I don't know, 15 minutes, something like that. And you can realistically go from like hours to 15 minutes with relatively little effort. It's like, you know, a very strategically placed effort by a smart team of engineers within like weeks, right? Going to like 5 minutes CI times that case is very hard because at some point there are just so many fixed costs in there. Just,
yeah.
That is like kind of, it becomes problematic. But going to like 15 minutes for a massive repo with like, you know, 1,000 engineers contributing to it is actually realistic, right? Going below, okay, that requires, you know, like some hard engineering, proper hats, you know, pencils, drawing on papers, you know, like proper rework.
Interesting.
Yeah, next thing you know, you're waiting overnight for a 3D image to render. Because I remember I used to have like a background in computer graphics, and that was like very typical to be like, all right, I'm just going to set this to render and then come back to it the next day. So it's so funny that, you know, here we are in a web world where we have all these compilations and code processes now, and we spend so much time waiting for them to finish. So yeah, tools like this.
Yeah, you can do a lot of cool things. Yeah, because like the question is here is mainly the moment you run end-to-end test in your repo, you're kind of doomed, right? And if you write enough end-to-end test, okay, that's, you know, that's hours of compute right there. So so it's anyway, it's not as uncommon this need, especially at like a sort of a larger work, right? I think most teams will hit this limit at some point.
Yeah, and if, for those of you who are individual devs out there, again, these aren't problems that you have until you have them. And it does usually take place in larger projects, and maybe not like larger in terms of size, but larger in terms of scope and breadth and people working on it. Yeah.
Cool. Is there anything else you wanted to mention before we move into the next section of this?
I would say one thing. So we talk about scale a lot. So I don't want to come across like, oh, if you have a small app, you know, go away, do your own stuff, you know.
Yeah.
Because like it's the same with TypeScript. TypeScript rocks at scale, I think. But it actually can be useful for at a small project because of the guidance it gives you, like refactoring works, etc. Auto completion works, things like that, right? So there is a second aspect to TypeScript, which happened to be useful at scale, but it's actually useful for new someone who's learning as well, right? You need to learn TypeScript, but at least when you use a new tool, right, it actually can guide you quite well, right? And same. Kind of here, if you say try to build a React Native app, right, with an X, because we generate so many things with VS Code support for you that you can just click through the file tree and kind of it will put the whole app together for you, right, and make it runnable, etc. The side effect is that it can be easier to use something, right, if you are new to that, right, because it is less common, like, it's less scary. You don't need to, like, copy and paste samples that don't fit exactly right or whatever, right? It kind of can scaffold things in a very sophisticated way. So that's the side effect that if you know, like, some new to a particular, like if you're trying out, you know, Remix or whatever, right? There are upsides to an egg that have nothing to do with scale. And like just side effects of us caring about developer ergonomics, right? And editor integration, things like that, right?
Awesome. Should we get into the questions we have here, Scott?
Yeah, we got to come up with a cool name for them. But right now, they're just lightning questions. Okay. There'll be some sort of supper club-based name. Uh-huh. Come and get it, questions.
So early, we don't even have a name for it. But we thought we would ask the same set of questions to every guest that comes on. So we'll sort of just rattle them at you, and you can answer however long you need to.
Okay, sounds good.
What computer and keyboard do you use?
Okay, so I use, I'm actually on a MacBook Pro 14, which I like. I used to go on Linux for years, but honestly, when M1 came out, M1 is like, and then now, you know, the M1 Max, etc. It's just so good that it's
kind of hard to resist.
Yeah. And the keyboard is, I use HHKB, which is I don't even know if it's considered mechanical, but it's basically a very unique switch made by one company in Japan. I like it a lot. I think it's very pleasant to type on, right? So HHKB.
A-C-H-K-B?
H-H.
Yeah, it's like, I think it's like something
Happy
Hacker.
Hacking.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Scott will put a link in the show notes for it. That sounds cool.
It's very cool. So it's like when you look at it, you're like, okay, that looks a bit retro, right?
Yeah.
Accepted. It's good, right? It's find a friend with such a keyboard so you can play with you know how it feels. It just feels very different from, let's say, you know, MX switches and stuff. So
interesting.
You
either
love the feeling or you don't like it. So if you love it, just get it because it's very hard to get the same feeling from MX compatible switches.
Yeah, this looks nice. I'm just looking at this. Cool. What about a phone?
A phone? It's just an iPhone. So I'm boring.
An iPhone. And text editor, theme, and font?
Okay, that's a... the text editor, I use three text editors depending on whom I'm speaking with.
Whoa. Wow.
So, and the reason is that they're good at different things, right? So for any heavy lifting development, I actually use IntelliJ with Solarized Dark, right? Because of the extra stuff IntelliJ gives me, that's just very hard to replace. For small edits, I use a Lunar Vim, which is like a set of plugins for NeoVim, which is a new version of Vim written in Lua. I like it. So it's like when you jump into like a folder and just, oh, wait a minute. Like, yeah, I can make a change in like 5 seconds and jump out and, you know, I don't need to open anything, right? It's convenient for that.
Ooh, this is
and
cool.
I use VS Code for all the demos. People love VS Code. I also love VS Code. VS Code is amazing. So because most people use VS Code in a web space at least, right? So I use all three. So my muscle memory is a bit kind of clunky, you know, when I switch between them.
No kidding.
Like, yeah, but it's, I would say most of the time you want more than one. Because it's very hard to beat Vim at small edits, but I kind of find it's not good enough for for big edits.
Yeah,
or, you know,
yeah.
At least for me, maybe I'm not good enough at it or something.
Oh, that's really interesting.
Yeah, next question. If you had to start from scratch right now, what would you choose to learn?
I actually don't know. It's a hard question. Depending on what I want to do. In general, I find that things that are timeless tend to be like Vim, for example, or like Bash or something like that, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, you look at it, okay, holy, why would I ever need it, right? When it's like, but I've, you know, been programming for many years, for 20 years, right?
Yeah.
And both of them are still around.
Right? Yeah, right, yeah.
So it's like, if someone chooses to learn Bash right now, I guarantee you, 10 years from now, you will still be using it. And I, in terms of practicality, I think JS is good. I like JavaScript / TypeScript. Because I like the how versatile it is at everything, right? So like pretty much anything you can place. I mean,
you
apart from like writing drivers or something, right? It just does it really well, right? And the tooling finally kind of on par with what, you know, Java and C Sharp used to have, right? Actually, VS Code right now is better, like basically there, right?
Yeah.
So you get fantastic tooling, and you know. It can do everything, right? And you have to use it anyway because you cannot get rid of it, right?
So,
but I actually
you
love
can't
it. I
dodge it.
I actually do love it. So people use it like, oh, I really would wish I use this. No, I actually think the TypeScript is like I enjoy writing it. Right, it makes me happy.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great to hear. What is one piece of advice you have for beginners? This is something we have all the time. We have lots of beginners listen to the podcast, and you've been at it for so long. You've probably seen everything. Any advice you have for beginners?
Yeah, there is one thing that I do that I know some other folks do, right? Which doesn't apply necessarily to beginners, but I think at the beginning, the impact is much stronger, right?
Yeah.
Is that if I learn something, let's say in a given week, I've learned some interesting thing, like I have a discovery about a particular tool or whatever, right? I would take my notebook, like I would show it right now. But anyways, the notebook is a spread, and I would draw a picture, right? A picture with few words possible, like a diagram with like idea. For me, picture would work better. Pointing out the lesson learned, right? The idea would be, imagine you read something about virtual machines, and you're like, ooh, that's pretty complicated, etc. Right? As a beginner, because it's, you know, sophisticated stuff, just draw a stack, put some references, imaginary like object, like just basic diagram, like that's what I have, right? And you do that once a week for 50 weeks, right? You have something that you discovered that week. Any week has interesting stuff, right? Just find one thing, right? Just one thing. Watch an interesting talk and then say, okay, I watched this talk. Let me convert the picture, right? And do it once a week. At the end of the year, you're going to have 50 pictures, right? A lot of senior engineers with like 20 years of experience don't have 50 interesting pictures in their hand. So you already be ahead of them. So it really doesn't take that long. If you just say, okay, I need to do, like, figure out one novel thing once a week, right? Something that really pushed me forward. Like, and like really in a few years, because everyone knows those like some juniors who are like, oh, I have 2 years of experience, and they're like super fast, super sharp, right? Have deep understanding of things, lack experience, right? But already kind of can do crazy stuff, right? And you're like, huh, you know, because they're more paying attention, right, to those type of things, right?
Oh, that's great. These questions are awesome, Scott. We're getting lots of good info.
How do you stay up to date on stuff?
Oh, this is a tough one. So I have people who tell me interesting things because I actually have my Twitter blocked. I only can write but cannot read, because I find it exhausts me so much.
Right? Wow.
Like, so I don't consume any social media, right? So usually I know enough super duper smart people who are on Twitter, right? And they tell me, read this one tweet and like watch this talk. And I get like a feed from, you know, this, not everyone has this luxury, obviously, right? But like I have a good network of people who are, you know, very smart and staying up to date, and they help me stay up to date without my having to pay this, for me, an enormous cost of being on Twitter, because I find that an hour on Twitter is like I get older, like I get 1,000 years older.
Yeah, I totally get that.
Wow. All right, last question. What is one thing you are really excited about in the future of web development?
Yeah, I'm actually pretty happy with how it's right now. I think that one thing I would like, maybe I would like to see is some form of types making into a JS spec, right?
So the
whether it will happen or not, you know, because there are advantages to optional typing, the way TypeScript does it, which is it's purely editor informing, but it's not execution informing, right? But really, if you had a few of those, perhaps the system could have been faster. When I was at on the Angular team, there was some talk on the Chrome team, they discussed it, etc. But it's hard to get it without, you know, screwing everyone over. So I don't know. So one thing, because I really believe JS and TS rock. Okay, so people like to say, oh, why don't you build everything in Rust and then plug it in with some like foreign language interface or whatever. You could, but there are advantages to just using the same language without having to transition to a different language, right? Either then, like, I expand the applicability of a particular tool to like 98% of use cases, something like that, right? And honestly, there are advantages to having like a lingua franca, the thing that everyone knows, right? As we all speak English, right? English is not my first language, right? We can coexist effectively and, you know, and have a lot of interesting collaborations as a result, right? The moment you divide folks, anyway. So I really believe that JS can be the space of this, you know, where everyone speaks it at least to some degree, and it's used for, you know, when the cooler things can come out as a result, right? And then they could in other amazing you know, communities, etc., right? Where they don't have the same property, right?
Yeah, totally.
All right. Well, last thing we want to ask you, is there anything you'd like to plug before we send you off on your way? We call it the shameless plug.
Yeah. It's, I mean, I've been plugging it the whole time, right? So go and check out NX if you are, especially if you're a JavaScript or TypeScript developer, you know, even if you don't end up using it, right? It can inform you about some other ways of developing that you can then, you know, try to implement, you know, on your own, right? So check it out. And if you have any questions, you know, you can go to our community Slack, ask questions. The core team hangs out there all the time. You can even DM me on Twitter. I don't use Twitter, but once a month I go and see if someone sent me a message. So it does happen very occasionally, so, and I might reply. So
awesome. Cool. Well, thank you so much for coming on. That was really helpful. It really gives some insight into tooling around monorepos, and we appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you, folks.
Yeah, thanks for coming on.
Thanks again.
Peace.
Peace.
Head on over to syntax.fm for a full archive of all of our shows. And don't forget to subscribe in your podcast player or drop a review if you like this show.